Welcome to ApplauseCast Travel. The following presentation is an interview with the author of travel, adventure, and humor writings, Tim Cahill. His books include A Wolverine Is Eating My Leg, Past the Butterworms, Remote Journeys Oddly Rendered, Lost in My Own Backyard, A Walk in Yellowstone National Park, Full the Enlightenment, More Travel, Less Bliss, Road Fever, Not So Funny When It Happened, The Best of Travel Humor and Misadventure, published by Traveler's Tales. We join the interview recorded on May 1st, 2006, hosted by Larry Haberger of Traveler's Tales and Stephen Mara of ApplauseCast.
Sure. This is Larry Haberger with Traveler's Tales, and we're here with Steve Morrow of ApplauseCast and Tim Cahill in his home in Livingston, Montana. Tim is the well-known, famous writer of great adventure stories from Outside Magazine and National Geographic Adventure. He started with Rolling Stone. He's written about a dozen books, and he's done a tremendous amount of traveling in exotic and marvelous and dangerous places all over the world. Tim, we're delighted to have you here with us today.
I'm happy to be here.
I wanted to ask you a quick question just to get us rolling. You have said before that adventure is physical and emotional discomfort recollected in tranquility, and the subtitle of one of your books, Past the Butterworms, is Remote Journeys Oddly Rendered. Do these two statements accurately reflect your work, do you think?
Pretty much. My job, as I've seen it for the last nearly 30 years, is to go to extremely remote places. I must say, though, that what's happened recently in the last dozen years, I'd say, is that the definition of remote has changed considerably. 30 years ago, I could go to some place like the cloud forests of Peru, and people had literally not seen a gringo before. Now, adventure travel companies routinely take people into those very same areas that I went to. What remote means today generally has to do with political instability in the country in question. So, what happens is that you, in order to get into these countries, you have to get by a line of guns. So you got to learn how to talk with your hands in the air and be able to run and hide.
I'm sure you do that pretty well.
So Tim, did you pick this up when you were hanging out with Robert Pelton?
No, actually, I had a minor reputation for going to dangerous places, and Pelton had a reputation for going to extremely dangerous places, and I was tasked with the magazine assignment of following Robert Pelton to see whether this guy was on the up and up or not. And I suspect this was one of the scariest trips I ever took, and Robert Pelton is certainly on the up and up. He was not only a fearless in the in his reporting, but seemed to delight in the idea of getting us into more and more trouble. It was funny because this was way before 9/11, and Pelton said, "Well, we've got two choices. We can go see this guy. I know where he is, in Afghanistan, named Osama bin Laden, or we could go down to Colombia and hang around with the guerrilla faction that's been fighting the Colombian government for the last nearly 40 years, the FARC." And since I speak a little bit of Spanish and felt more comfortable in South America in a dangerous situation, I chose Colombia. I wonder whether we would have ever found Osama bin Laden. At that time, he was pretty sure.
I wonder how your life would have changed and your career would have changed if you'd gone to see Osama bin Laden.
Well, yeah. If my career and life might have changed considerably. I wonder, I have a fear that I might have bought a snow job and written a less than perceptive piece on bin Laden. I think I did a pretty good job on the FARC and also a pretty good job on Pelton.
Yeah.
We remain friends and in contact today. He's you know, if he's not being kidnapped or breaking his wrist in a motorcycle accident in South America, he claims he's going to come up here one day to Montana and we'll have some beers and relive.
That sounds great. Well, Tim, in your career, you've written a lot about danger and fear. And is that because both get people's attention and most people don't want to face either?
The reason that I originally wrote a great deal about risk had to do with the fact that I was interested in the mechanics of fear and the mechanics of risk. I wondered why people did it. I was fascinated by rock climbers and mountain climbers in the same way Hemingway and his ilk were fascinated by matadors in the 1930s. I thought these were people that were working on the edge, and I wondered what in hell they could possibly get out of it. And I started as a younger guy doing a little bit of climbing and began to see that it was about control. It was about ecstasy. It was about having control over your own life. For instance, if you're jumping out of an airplane, you're the only guy that can pull the ripcord. There's nobody else that can do it for you, and so you have to do it. The world that we live in now is the one that's the rules are made almost entirely by lawyers, and nothing is your fault. Taking risks is a way of taking control over your own life, and if you get hurt, it's your own fault. Now, I don't know if you see my point here, but my point is that it's for once, you are the one that is completely in control, and nobody else is at that particular moment. There's also something else. The risk workers, the edge workers of my acquaintance, were always they always found a certain amount of tranquility and normalcy after the risky stunt was completed. It's almost it was interesting to see, and I wondered if some of these people, in fact, did the risky their particular risky business for the resultant tranquility. I can tell you something about myself and the fact that I was doing. In fact, I can tell you many many things. I had completed a book on, it was my first published book. It was a national bestseller, but it was about a serial killer in Chicago named John Wayne Gacy, who killed 33 young boys and buried them in his basement and out behind his garage. I spent 3 years in the sewer of that man's mind, and it was a book that was about pure evil as far as I was concerned. I don't think that that was, I've never done such a book again, and never will. But I needed something to take my mind off of the obsession with human evil. And pure logic demanded that the antidote be at least as intense as the fomenting book itself. And I think I engaged in risk early on in my career as a form of therapy. I was looking for that control over my own life and the resultant tranquility. I also think there's an old Scottish adage that some men are born two drinks short of par. I like that now, and I compared that a lot to the adrenaline seeking people that I knew. It seems like some of us are born a couple of jolts of adrenaline short.
Tim, let me ask you, or let me read something to you. This is Steve, and just get your response to it. One is the phony epiphany on the mountaintop. Listen, I've got 30 years in this, and you don't have an epiphany on the mountaintop. You might have it 5 days later when you're down the hill. That seems kind of in line with what you were saying.
Yeah, exactly. I read a number of travel magazines, and many of them include outdoor adventures, and I'm suspicious of the epiphany on the mountaintop. The mountaintops that I've gotten to, I've on my own steam, I've been exhausted, tired, worried about getting down. It's only 3 or 4 days later when you're lying under the ceiling fan in some third world country with a mosquito coil burning by your side that you may be able to come to grips
with. What just happened?
Yeah, what that particular.
You know, Tim, when I'm not doing interviews, I'm a pilot, and that paragraph reminded me of what it was like when I soloed. I was expecting Neil Armstrong and Charles Lindbergh like feelings, and all I felt when I got down after making my 3 takeoffs and landings was immense gratitude to be back on the ground. And it was 4 or 5 days later that I was able to really kind of enjoy it and embellish it. But the actual process was not particularly fun.
And there's something about training for an event. If I'm going to go out and do something, I mean, I'm not entirely stupid. And I did engage in athletics from the time I was 10 years old throughout college, and I know a little bit about training. And here's what happens. When a person trains assiduously for an event, and the event happens, you suddenly attack it in a way that has nothing to do with thinking in the ordinary sense, especially for a person like myself who is habitually kind of moody and brooding. There's none of that. You act in a manner that the writer Diane Ackerman called creatural. It's not quite instinctive. It's creatural. And that has been described by a professor late of the University of Chicago, whose name I can't pronounce, Mahaley Chesmahaley, I believe, and he called it the flow. and one enters the flow. People enter the flow if they are deeply involved in something. For instance, a neurosurgeon might experience a five-hour operation as something that took a little more than 15 minutes, whereas a ballerina might feel a certain move took all of 15 minutes when, of course, it took less than 15 seconds. Composers at work, writing scores, not playing music, writing scores, have been known not to hear the doorbell ring. And people climbing mountains or kayaking rough water, class 4, class 5 rapids, enter the flow that way. The flow has been described as something very similar to Eastern meditative states. I think maybe that's where the yoga article came in that I was talking about earlier. These Eastern meditational states, some people can get there by sitting cross-legged in a room, and others of us need a little harder bump. We were born 2 drinks short of par, or maybe a couple of jolts of adrenaline short of
par. So, Tim, would you say then that your training as a swimmer, you were a competitive swimmer at the University of Wisconsin, would you say that that gave you a good background in training for the career that you ultimately took up?
It helped me learn that you can train to overcome many obstacles. My coach had 2 important phrases that he always repeated. There is no barrier, and pain is the purifier. I learned those 2 things from my coach, and I learned a little bit about what competition means. Well, I was swimming in the Big Ten and the NCAA, and actually set a few records, which have since been horribly shattered. But I, you know,
well, they lasted for some period of time. That's great.
You know, Tim, I've got a couple of swimming questions that I'm going to save to the end. But let me take a slightly different approach on this conversation. This morning I did a Google, and I put in Tim Cahill author, and came back with 387,000 hits. I put in my own name, and I came back with 393 hits, 2 of which were me. I then did Mr. Ed, if you remember Mr. Ed from the TV series. Okay,
yes,
Mr. Ed had 85 million. And finally, in tribute to TV, I did Jerry Mathers, who's, of course, the Beaver, and he came back with 562,000.
I've done my own vanity search, and there seems to be a good soccer player.
I was going to mention that. There is a Tim Cahill soccer player. I found him, too.
Yeah, and there's somebody who's the treasurer of the state of
I found him as
Massachusetts.
Well.
they're horning in on my quarter million mentions.
Well, it was the Mr.
Internet.
Ed number that kind of surprised me at 85 million.
Well, I could write the most brilliant masterpiece, but I'll tell you, I can't compete with a talking horse.
I don't know anybody who can. Well, Tim, I wanted to ask you a little something about your career. You know, some people plan their careers where they go to college and then they go get their MBA and they go on to Wall Street, or they go to law school and then they become a legal drudge and they go to be an associate and a partner. That's their whole ambition. And what, if any, planning did you do, and what role did serendipity play in you getting where you are today?
I wanted to be a writer from the time I was about 13 or 14 years old, but I grew up in a small town in Wisconsin. I knew no writers, and since I took the idea of being a writer very, very seriously and took writing very, very seriously, I assumed that it was that writers were all godlike persons. Now, many of my friends are writers, and I assure you that that was a mistaken apprehension on my part at that time. But anyway, I thought that if I told anybody that I wanted to be a writer, I would appear to be immodest. And so I kept this little secret to myself, and I went through the University of Wisconsin majoring in history, which is really just stories that you plug dates into and analyze, which was turned out to be not too bad training for me. I went to law school for one semester and did extremely well, and said, you know, if this crap keeps up, I'm going to have to be a lawyer. And I never tried to be what I really wanted to be. Now, I wasn't married, and I didn't have kids at the time, and so it was okay for me to go to some other place and starve to death trying to be a writer. And I went to San Francisco. I got a Master of Fine Arts in English Creative Writing, and wrote a mercifully unpublished novel, and 2 years later scored a job with this goofy little magazine that was starting off south of Mission in San Francisco called Rolling Stone. And
how did that happen? How did you get that job with Rolling Stone?
I had an English teacher who rather liked my novel and presented it to one of the great writers of Rolling Stone at the time, whose name was Grover Lewis. Grover read the book and found many of the obvious and clear faults in it, but also apparently saw a little bit of talent in it, and I was hired
Tim, being a rock and roll fan, I confess I still read Rolling Stone magazine, though most of the time now I just look at the pictures. When you wrote for Rolling Stone, can you share with us some of the articles that you wrote?
I didn't actually know what my métier was going to be, and so I tried a lot of different things. Obviously, the first things I did was were rock and roll stories, that got boring pretty fast, you know. On the road with the rock and roll band, the sound check with the rock and roll band, backstage while the rock and roll band played, back to the hotel room, wreck the hotel room with the rock and roll band, get an airplane with a terrible hangover, and do it all again tomorrow night. After about 2 years, I didn't want to do that anymore. I did some investigative reporting. I suspect the culmination of that was the story I did on Jonestown, the 900 people who committed suicide and killed themselves in Jonestown, Guyana. I actually did some political work. I did a lot of personality profiles and some on-the-set movie things. I was on the set of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. These days, they don't let journalists hang around on the set anymore, but back in those days, they were not wise to the fact that we might not always write the most
favorite
story. So then
from Rolling Stone, you know, I got to ask one thing, again, because I'm a rock and roll fan. You got to just tell me one or two of the bands that you got to hang out with.
Well, you have to understand that I was the new guy. So my first feature, for a while I wrote what we call 2020 News. That was the rock and roll news of the day. My first feature was on Donovan. Donovan was
his thing was Mellow Yellow.
Oh, yeah, Mellow Yellow, and first there is a mountain, then there is no mountain.
I remember that.
Yeah. And none of the heavy hitters at Rolling Stone at that particular time wanted to do Donovan, so I did Donovan, and I actually had a good time and wrote a story that was, I feel, both funny and insightful, and so I was given other people to do. But you have to remember that I was a guy that was doing people that were not in the top echelon of the things. I did do Greg Allman. I did do Loggins and Messina. I did do Neil Young. It was the late 60s and early 70s, so I can't remember.
So Tim, let me ask you a question about craft. You've been doing magazine work for 25 or 30 years now. When you get an assignment, how do you approach it? What kind of research do you do in advance? And do you like to hit the ground prepared, or do you prefer to form your own first impressions when you get there?
No, I like to hit the ground prepared. I like to read as much as I can possibly read about the area that I'm going. That has been, especially the stuff that's been most recently written. Obviously, people are going to have certain things happen in certain places, and people are going to have pretty much the same perception of what's happening there. And I would like to be able to, share those perceptions with the readers, but go beyond anything that's been written in the recent past. So I do, I tend to do a lot of research, and strangely enough, I do quite a bit of research reading when I'm actually at the place. Sometimes you feel actually pretty foolish. I remember being in the hills of the Himalayas reading a book about people who live in the hills of the Himalayas, and I was surrounded by people who lived in the hills of the Himalayas asking me what I was reading.
Yeah, that can happen. That's pretty funny. So what did you reply to them? Reading all about you. Huh?
I read the Well, I read them it said that they didn't take their Hinduism quite as seriously as people in the lowlands did. They frequently ate meat, didn't honor the same gods in quite the same ways, and I asked them whether that was true, and they said, oh, yeah, that's true.
That's great.
You know, Tim, in terms of your writing, I read another quote from you that you said that you know tricks how to make it smooth, and how you can make the structure work. Maybe you can tell us something about those tricks.
There's no trick to it, really. It's all like a joke. It is precisely similar to the way you do a joke and tell a good joke. You have a good setup, and the setup leads you to your punchline. And you can do the same thing in crafting a scene. A scene, it may end up making you feel sorrowful, but what you need to do is set it up so that the reader understands it, and then you hit them with the final result of the scene, which in some cases I am endeavoring to make the reader feel a strong emotion. So I often try to make them laugh and cry in the same piece. I used to tell students who were trying to write a magazine article, I used to tell them that if you can make them laugh and cry in the same piece, you've created an illusion of depth. The more I think about it, the more I think you've probably actually created some depth.
One thing that's interesting, I think, about your work is the structure of your stories is really cleverly crafted. And I think in some ways it's so smooth that the readers don't often even notice what you're doing with them because the narrative flows so well. Now, I know you put a lot of time and attention into that, but one story that I would like to just ask you about in regards to the structure and the way you put it together is, I think it was from Hold the Enlightenment, your collection, and it was called Fully Unprepared. And in that story, you start with this sort of wacky opening description. And what I admire about it is, you open with this description of a scene of kind of this weird baseball scene. And it turns out very quickly we realize that you were in bed in the hospital. And then this nurse with red hair comes in and she reminds you of your ex-wife who liked literature. And then you go into a riff on Proust. And then you go into a discussion of the spinal damage that you're in the hospital for. And then you tell us the narrative of the fall, how this all happened. And then you move on to the death of your first wife and then the resolution of your hospital scene. And I've kind of laid out the whole story there, but the reason I did that is the structure of the piece, I thought, was really impressive. And it took all of these disparate elements and sewed them all together in such a way that the narrative flowed very, very effortlessly. So I just wanted to ask you, how much attention and time do you put into getting these scenes structured in just such a way that you can jump back and forth in time and yet keep the narrative flowing so the reader never gets lost?
It's a two-part process, actually. The first part of the process is getting stuff down on paper, and that is very, very difficult. I think you probably recall the great sports writer Red Cannon's saying that writing is real easy. All you do is roll a blank piece of paper into your typewriter and stare at it until drops of blood form on your forehead. I call that the terror of the blank page. And so what I do is I write my stories in various pieces. I know that there's some story that I want to tell. And so I will write that particular story. And then there's another story I want to tell. And these are all spread out. And they may not even have a linear coherence to them. And so what I do is when I'm basically finished with this particular part of the process is read the stories that I've written and try to see how in the world they hold together. Now, they might not have a linear structure. So I think to myself, okay, Tim, you're going to trust yourself. This came out of your subconscious mind somewhere. That must mean it's connected somewhere. Structuring a story is sometimes a process of self-analysis. What do I mean? What am I trying to say? Where does this all come from? That's the way I put it together. That particular story, it's funny that you should mention that because the hit in that story comes way towards the end. It's structured a bit differently than a whole lot of other stories
that
I've written.
Do you write every day?
I try to write every day. I get up in the morning, I make some coffee, and the rule is that I have to be sitting at my desk and working within half an hour after I get up. I talked about the flow that you can get into when you've practiced something and you're doing it, the flow that might come when you're rock climbing and you're moving easily from one ledge to the next, to the next, to the next, hardly even thinking about it. Your mind isn't there. The same thing happens with writing. It's a wonderful feeling. You sit down, you start writing, and suddenly 3 or 4 hours have passed. You may have written something funny. You may even have known that's funny, but you never laugh. You say, yep, that's funny, as you're working. Okay, this works, this works. This is not working. And when you get done with a day like that where you were in the flow, where whatever it was seemed to be coming from somewhere outside of you. There's nothing to equal that feeling. I simply don't know why it takes me. There's some kind of perfectionist fear that it takes me a long time to get into that that flow, and so I want to get at it immediately. I mean, first thing in the morning. And my wife will tell you that I'm not entirely coherent nor very pleasant first thing in the morning. But I better be writing first thing in the morning, because if I let it go for even 2 hours, the magnitude of the task ahead of me and my complete lack of ability to accomplish that task will have occurred to me, and nothing will get done that day. I used to allow myself to read the newspaper. You could read the newspaper before you go to work, and then I'd find myself procrastinating. I would read every single classified
ad. Even the obituaries,
right? Yeah, right. So, my process is to work. If I can get 3 or 4 good hours of blank page writing in, and I might even be exaggerating that, if I can get 3 hours of blank page writing in, I'm good. And if I entered the flow of that particular day, I will be elated for the rest of the day. But then the rest of the day is, you can go back over things and think about structure and think about how this scene might come before that scene. And I call them tricks, but it's really very easy. I mean, you're going to start with your second best story. You're going to end with your best story. That's a pretty clear rule that you can follow. I can polish, proofread, research. Then it's time to hurry down to the bar.
I was about to ask you, Tim, which is your favorite part of that process? I think I know the answer. But seriously, what part of that process do you enjoy the most? The blank page writing, where you get into the flow, or the revision and the restructuring?
Nothing feels better than getting into the flow and bringing something out of nowhere, something that even surprises you. You didn't know that this was what you were thinking. You where did this come from? This is incredible. What you must do before this will happen to you, however, is that you must know your material backwards and forwards. I usually fill up at least 2 70-page notebooks that reporters use, those 5x8 notebooks. And if it's slow and I have more time, I actually have a large spiral notebook that I can take some of the things from the smaller notebooks and write them out into whole scenes that sometimes transfer themselves with very little editing and polishing right to the finished published page.
Has technology changed your writing style? I mean, now that you can do it online or Google or just word processors and spell checkers and all those kinds of things?
No, I really haven't changed that particular process. Research is easier. That's one thing. I mean, I used to, years ago, spend at least a couple days a week driving over to the local university and using their library to come up with various research-related items I needed to know. When I did things with a typewriter, I could tell you that I was, at the minimum, a 3-draft writer. There were the three processes that I've already kind of talked about. The first is vomit. You get it all out on the page. And in order to mitigate the fear of the blank page, I particularly like to write scenes that I know are going to be in the story. They will probably set the tone of the story, the way the story feels. They will set whether I'm doing it in first person or omniscient narrator, because this scene will probably be a crux of the story somewhere. Then I write several other scenes. All of this means that I'm going to have to rewrite when I structure, because I've set up the scene, and I told you a scene, any scene is like a joke. It's got setups and punchlines. And what you want to do when you're writing is to take some of those setups and use them much earlier in the piece than the scene that is the crux of the piece, so that the piece seems to run together organically. The second part of the process that I used to do was literally cut and paste. I would have all the stuff that I'd written, and I'd cut some stuff out. I mean, literally with the scissors and Scotch tape, and put that together. And then I would sit and do a final thing where I thought I had the structure together, and I would write the structure piece and polish it. Usually there was a fourth draft where I polished a second time. So I was a 3-4 draft writer that I could tell. You can't really tell on a computer how many drafts you go through, but I don't see much difference in the process myself. The only difference in a computer is, if you watched me at a typewriter, what you would have seen is a man sitting there for a long period of time, because I would probably compose a paragraph in my mind before I started typing. On a computer, I can compose that paragraph on the page, write it, say, "Well, that doesn't work. You know, let's go back, do it again, do it again." That stuff I did 20-some years ago, I did
and that makes
in
sense.
My head.
Because you don't want to have to go back and retype, pull the paper out, and yeah.
Oh God, that was the most tedious part of working on a typewriter, when you knew you had it, when you knew you had it done. You'd probably taken out that third draft and crossed out some things and scribbled in some words and crossed out some more things and scribbled in some words and drew a line saying this paragraph belongs here, that paragraph belongs here, and then saying, oh, I need another explanation of this. So you'd have page 12A and maybe page 12B, and you would put where they had to go. And that meant you had to, you couldn't very well hand something like that in. You had to retype the thing. And retyping is going to take you, at the very least, half a day.
Those days are gone. Hallelujah. Yeah.
Hallelujah. Did you work on a typewriter too, Larry?
Oh, I remember well.
Yeah.
It's a completely different process. Listen, I've got a couple more questions for you before we go. I know you've had a long time with us today, and we appreciate it. One question I have is, what would you say to someone who asks, how can I become you? The reason I ask the question is I know you've inspired a lot of people with your work over the years, and I happen to know one person in particular who went into travel writing because of you. You are her hero. So what would you say to somebody who came up to you and said, how can I become you?
The real simplest answer is that a lot of people like the idea that I get to travel, I get to go to remote places. Those are just things that get my creative juices flowing. But I had an epiphany of sorts when I took the fall off the cliff in the Queen Charlotte Islands, and for quite some time I couldn't walk. That meant I couldn't go to any kind of remote places at all. It became very clear to me that I was still writing, and writing about other things around the house, things that I observed. It's not the traveling, it's not being in shape, it's not being a great linguist. What it is being able to write, and specifically to find the story wherever you are. Wherever you are, there's going to be a story. You have to find it, and once you find it, write it down. I've been doing it long enough now that I know that something that's happening, yes, I can write that well. So the advice that I would give to anyone, and it's just, it's the most prosaic advice, but unfortunately, it's the truth, is write. Write as much as you possibly can. Write every day. It's like anything else. It's practice.
Tim, let me ask you my kind of closing question. I have an 8-year-old daughter named Kate who is a competitive swimmer and swimming for Team USA. And I was telling her yesterday who I was going to be talking to today and your swimming background. So I said, what do you want me to ask Tim? So she had three things she wanted me to ask you. What events did you compete in swimming?
All right. Anything you wanted done in a hurry. I did individual medley, which is all the strokes combined.
Right, the IM.
The IM. I was. They put me in the IM occasionally just because they needed somebody who could do this. My actual strokes were freestyle sprints, 1500, and
what was your fastest
butterfly. Freestyle sprints.
And her last
sure.
question, because she knows that you travel to all these wonderful exotic places, did you ever eat fried worms?
Did I ever eat fried worms? Yes, I did. I've eaten fried worms more times than I care to tell you about. But I ate fried worms in Irianjaya. They are the worms of the sago palm. And the sago palm is cut apart, put through a fibrous filter, and made into a kind of a sour-tasting dough, which a kind of bread can be made from. This is all carbohydrates, and the people that live there live off of that, and their protein consists largely of the worms that can be found in these sago palms. And they are often put on the fire and fried. I saw the same thing in Tanzania, where they cut into an acacia tree and took out acacia worms, which are big, the size of your thumb, perhaps. And these poor guys are impaled on a stick and slowly roasted alive, I regret to tell you, over an open fire, and eaten.
I thought you were going to tell me you got them in Paris.
No, those are escargot.
That's right. Listen, well, Tim, I have one last question for you before we wrap up here. Apart from your own books, what's your short list of maybe three books that you would recommend that every beginning writer or general reader should read?
One of my great literary heroes is Edward Abbey. So, some of the very first Edward Abbey book called Desert Solitaire just literally knocked me off of my chair when I read it. You could write about the outdoors in a way that was funny, smart, concerned, meaningful. I think specifically of a story that in that first book, Desert Solitaire, called Dead Man at Grandview Point, that concerns itself with life, death, the cosmos, and the desert itself. So I like that. Abbey, just about anything by Peter Matheson. Man has written at least a dozen books that are could be called classics. I particularly like one of his fiction books called It Play in the Fields of the Lord. I think V.S. Naipaul is his book about India, Wounded Civilization, is one of the great books. Jan Morris is a hero of mine as well. Her Victoria trilogy is probably one of the most amazing books that I've had the chance to read in the last couple of years.
That's the collection on the rise and fall of the British Empire?
Yeah, it's three books, and Jan wrote it when she was James Morris. So right. The last book she wrote is James Morris.
Listen, we really appreciate you taking so much time with us today.
Good. I hope it went well.
Well, I'm sure it did. I think it did.
No, I think it was a wonderful time, and we just very, very much appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
This has been an ApplauseCast production. If you'd like to leave us email regarding tonight's podcast, drop us a line at ontheair@applausecast.com. If you'd like to have ApplauseCast produce a podcast for you or your organization, email us at sales@applausecast.com or call us at 650-400-3929. Thanks for listening.